my friend, he just actually just messaged me just now. He was just like, that's the best player that never played in the NBA. And I was just like, for real? Like,
Eric, the undersized and underappreciated overseas superstar.
Again, what's up, man? Good to meet you.
You were one of the, well, Brandon Jennings too, but you were one of the few people that transitioned from college into overseas professional basketball. So I want to talk about what that process was like for you to transition into something like that. Did you have to have an agent? How did you get in contact? What was that first, that step for you?
Yeah, it was tough because I didn't even know where to begin. All I knew was that if I just try to dominate, and I went to a small school, NAIA school, Division II. So I just thought if I dominate, maybe they'll find me. You know, if not, worst case scenario, I got a degree from a good school. I'll go use this business degree and work my way up the corporate ladder. And so I just, season ended. We lost in, it was the conference tournament. And crazy, the team that we ended up losing to, we lost in double overtime. I think they ended up winning the national championship that year. But we lost to them. I think I had like 40-something, maybe like 42, I don't know, my last game. And I don't know what to do. The season ends and I'm just like, you're a little bit depressed. You know, you pour so much into the game. It's been 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. I haven't heard nothing. I don't know what to do. I asked my coaches, and then like the seventh day, my coaches start getting calls and emails from agents asking if they can get my information, they can reach out. And so it took 7 days and I'm just like, all right, okay, maybe there's a chance now. Okay, the dream is still alive. Like, I don't got to do a 9-to-5 yet. Okay, and so then they start calling, and I'm trying to feel my way. I don't really know a lot, but I talked to some guys who played overseas. I'm reaching out to them on Facebook because that was, you know, I'm so old that that was the main means of communication outside of a phone when I was in college. But I'm reaching out and they're giving me like ideas of questions I should ask, what I should be looking for. And so, you know, I'm just asking the typical questions. Have you seen me play? Like, I'm in this little school, Northern Indiana. Like, have you seen me play? Number two, if you have seen me play, what countries do you think my style fits? You know, where do you see me as? What's my starting salary range? I know you can't pinpoint an exact number, but a guy of my profile, my type of game, where do you see me potentially starting? If you do have guys like me, where do you normally place them? Have you placed any other Division II, NAIA, or guys who were non-Division I players? Have you placed them overseas? Like, these are valid questions because that tells me you have the experience to get guys to where they need to go. So after asking these questions, having these talk downs with all these agents, basically all through the phone, because at that point, I'm not really viable enough to come visit, but I'm viable enough to call. Like, and I understood that, like, you know, my ego was not bruised. You know, I went to a small college, you know, D1's didn't offer me. Like, at that point, like, it is what it is. Like, and after I broke down who I wanted as my agents, and he literally found me because I made SportsCenter top 10 highlights. I think I was like number 2 or 3 play where I like jumped over a dude. Got a steal, jumped over a guy, dunked it in one. And then he seen my last name, and he actually graduated from Bucknell. And my brother at the time was a freshman at Lehigh. And so he's like, McCullum. And he looks up, and then he says, I looked you up online. He's like, I never seen you play in person. But after you did that dunk, I'm like, McCullum, let me check out his brother. And he said, your film was unbelievable. Like, just the moves, the shots, your statistics was crazy. I think I averaged maybe 26 a game or something, and maybe 7-8 rebounds. But, and he was just saying like the things I was doing, my athleticism, like I was a Division I caliber player. So, you know, he took me on, you know, I went with him. I liked him. He was honest. He told me everything, you know, he thought about me. And at that point, school was good, but the teams couldn't differentiate. What's the difference between a guy who scores 26 points a game at an NAIA D2 compared to, let's say, a guy at a mid-major who averages 12, 13? Like, a lot of teams overseas, they couldn't differentiate, like, my level I was playing at, the type of competition, like, does my stuff translate? So during this time, there was, like, a popular camp in Vegas. And so my agent flew me out there, got me a hotel, and was like, look, this is exposure camp. It's during NBA Summer League, too, but the camp is during the day. NBA Summer League is in the late afternoon and evening. So all the scouts are going to come here. They're going to watch. And then they'll go eat lunch, whatever, and then they'll go to NBA Summer League. So he flew me out there, and he was like, look, you need to dunk everything in warm-ups. Crazy. Yeah. He was like, every dunk you got. So I'm in there 360 in, windmill, reverse. I'm like, and I was like really bouncy. Like, I still can jump a little bit, but like when I was young, I was really bouncy. And he's like, so when you're doing that, I'm going to be working the sideline, and I'm going to be talking to each guy. Yeah, you see my guy right there, number three. That's my guy. And so I'm
that's my guy.
So now they see me getting freaky in warm-ups, and they like, oh, okay. You know, because everybody loves an athlete. And then the game start, and this is where I shine. I'm skilled. You know, I can shoot. I can play off the bounce. I play pick and roll. I'm good in ISO. And you know, I just was dominating. And it's one of those camps where everybody play equal minutes, and you sub in platoon, 5 and 5, like you're Kentucky. And I'm in there, and I'm leading. I'm the only non-Division I player. And I'm like the leading scorer at the camp. I'm playing 20 minutes, dropping 25, 20 minutes, 20 points. Like, it's just boom, buckets, buckets. And I'm there with a different mindset. Like, yo, I ain't going out. I'm not casino. I'm not gambling. I'm not drinking. I'm here to kill. Like, and that's it. And from there, he literally took all the clips of the games. And so for any teams who couldn't differentiate my level of play, he was highlighting guys. Boom. 4-year starter, a 3-year starter, North Texas, boom, Mac, boom. And they getting highlighted and they getting cooked. And it's just me just going to work. And it's just, and then after that, that's when I started to get a few offers, and we settled it on Israel. And that's kind of how it all started. Like, it was a crazy journey, but it's constantly proving yourself. And once you finally solidify yourself and you show what you can do, then you get the job, and then you got to prove yourself all over again. So, you know, I'm just thankful I got that opportunity, and I had someone like my agent who believed in me. I've been with him for 14 years. So, you know, shout out to Andrew Morrison, CAA.
If I remember correctly, there was a quote you had on another podcast where you were saying that there's a Israeli rule where two Israeli players have to be on the court at the same time, right? And I think you guys had maybe 5 or 6 other foreign players. What was your mindset like? Because obviously you're getting less minutes with that rule in place. What was your mindset like that first year where you're still trying to prove yourself, you're trying to get that ground, but you can't necessarily get in the game and dominate because of a rule like that?
So I was just thinking, like, how can I help the team? And I'm looking around and I'm thinking, what can I do that these other 5 foreigners can't do? And I'm like, all right, I'm younger, I'm more athletic. All right, I got to pressure the ball. So I'm full court pressing. I need to get on this court. If I need to be Patrick Beverly, you know, this is what I'm going to do. Like, I'm full court pressing. I'm like, all right, I have to make positive plays. Like, anytime I come on the court, I can't turn over. I have to hit open shots. I have to run the offense, because this is a time when, you got to remember, 14 years ago, they did not like scoring point guards. This is when Steve Nash was winning MVPs. Right. This is before Steph Curry. This is before Derrick Rose. Like, they wanted their point guard strictly to be set up men in Europe and in the NBA. And that was pass first. And so I had to like adapt my whole game. And I'm wondering, like, man, I almost scored like 3,000 points in college, and you going to sign me to pass? Like, like, that's what you're doing?
Pass and play defense, this ain't me.
I'm like, what is going on? And they like, yeah, we seen you was all defensive team in college. And I'm like, all right. So I literally had to be a player that I wasn't really comfortable with. And that kind of got me, you know, more focused, because now I have to pay attention to detail. I have to do all these little things. I'm back to a role player, and, you know, I'm an intangible guy, but I have like a big offensive talent. And you see it with a lot of young rookies in the league. You'll see them come in, you'll be like, man, they can really fill it up, but that's not what that team need. And so every now and then I would get to showcase it. Let's say the game got out of hand, things went bad, or guys are struggling, and then the coach would be like, high ball screen, Eric, go. And then I'd be like, oh, yes, this is my chance. Like, and it wasn't often. It was like maybe like once every like 10 games. Like, just things ain't working. Guys are foul trouble. But, you know, when he did call my name, I was able to show. I wish I could have got more opportunities. But I understand that, like, in life, things happen. I think if they would have played me what I deserved, because I worked hard, I did everything, I dominated in practice, I did my job, but I was the youngest, I was the lowest paid, and there's 6 foreigners, only 3 of us can be on the court. So, you know, when you explain to management, you bring in this rookie, he's supposed to be a project, he's coming from a small school, but he just as good or better than those guys in his positions, but they making 4-5x his salary, you know, how you explain that, you know? So I understood as I got older. At that time, I didn't. I was really frustrated, but I had good vets. They told me just to stay focused, you know, keep a good attitude. They was like, you're going to be a great player. You just got to wait your time. And I'm like, man, I ain't trying to wait. I want it now. Like, but I had to wait. And, you know, it humbled me. It humbled me, and it made me really dig deep to see how much I love this, because, you know, you work, you grind, you pour so much into the game, and it feels like you get nothing in return. And it's like every day. And am I still going to come lift? Am I still going to come shoot? I know I ain't about to play much. I'm about to play 5 minutes. I don't need to work out for 5 minutes. And you can't allow your mindset to go there. And I luckily stayed working. You know, I had, you know, my brother, my parents pushing me along the way, you know, telling me to keep going. And I had great vets, you know, Romeo Travis, Elton Brown, like they was just there for me and helping lift me up when I needed it most. And I think that changed everything. And even Joe Smith was helping me a lot as well.
When you put pressure on yourself, like you got to change your game to make sure you're on the court, or you got to do this to stay noticed, is that something that motivates you and pushes you forward?
Yeah, it was stressful. Pressure can be beneficial because it's going to make you work harder. It's going to make you spend extra time. It's going to always keep you on alert. You know, I compare it to an animal, right? I'm hungry. I'm starving. I'm not full. I'm always looking for my next meal. So, like, it's like I'm always on go. In practice, I'm in go. In a game, I'm in go, because it's like I always got something to prove. But, you know, when you don't have pressure, sometimes you can get a little relaxed. You can get a little timid. You can kind of rest on your morals and, you know, all the stuff that you've done, you know, in the past. And, you know, I didn't want to do that. And I think what kind of set the tone is, on my first contract, there was a 30-day period where they could get out the contract or I could. So that first month, it was kind of like my contract was fully guaranteed after that 30 days. So, like, I don't stress. I'm like, man, every day I got to treat it like a game. So that's kind of how I started my career, my first year. My second year, I had a 14-day period, because this is, like, what I had to do coming from a small college. Like, I'm the only guy in the first division Israel who didn't play D1. Mm. And so I'm trying to, like, show my way. And so my agent was so confident. He like, all right, bet. Y'all don't know if he can play here, but y'all like him. Y'all like his film. Y'all want to offer him. I'm going to give y'all some security. I'm going to pay for his own flight there. And y'all can have that 30-day window, your tryout period. And then once y'all keep him after this 30 days, send me my money back for his flight. And that's how it went. They sent the money back, and my contract became fully guaranteed. And I say that to say, like, I was stressed. Like, you know, I felt like every day I was getting critiqued. Every day I was getting graded, and I had to bring it. And I was just... It was a relief when I got to day 31. You know, they made me wait to day 28, you know, before they like, all right. I'm like, y'all could have did this like 2 weeks in, but I think they wanted to see what I was made of. And now it's different. Like, it's a different stress. Like, I was trying to prove my career. I was trying to make a name for myself. I was trying to make basketball a way of life for me. And I was trying to change my life. And you know, I wasn't married. I didn't have kids at the time, but I wanted that in the future, and I wanted to be able to change their life. Now, the stress is just maintaining. I just want to continue to play at a high level. I want to continue to, you know, live up to my name, you know, represent my organization well, my family, like all those type of things. I want, you know, I don't want you when you come to the court to be like, yeah, E.O. Now, I want you to be like, dang, like E will cook you still. Like, there ain't no question to it. So it's different. Like, once I'm fighting for survival for my life, obviously I have a degree, you know, I can go get a good job, went to a great, you know, academic institution, I'll be fine. But for me, I'm fine for my survival, because I wanted basketball to be my way of living. And then now I'm already set, you know, I already managed everything. I have my passive income, I have all these things. So now it's just about, you know, your legacy and continue to play. I want to be done with the game before it's done with me, if that makes sense.
When you take on endeavors like this, where your agent is paying for flights and he believes in you strongly, to where financially money's coming out of his pocket, right? Which is a huge thing for anyone to do for anybody. You take on that aspect, and then you factor that in with the fact that you're the only D2 player amongst D1 players playing overseas professionally. At what point in time, if any, did you have the feeling like, damn, maybe I'm not supposed to be here? Did that ever run through your mind?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of guys gonna lie. They're not gonna keep it 100. Like I was sitting there and I felt overwhelmed. I'm like, dang. So I'm like, at the time, I'm watching, and there's a team called Maccabi Tel Aviv And I don't really understand the EuroLeague or this type of things, but like you start to hear like history and I'm watching, I'm like, dang, they got Jeremy Pargo. You know, I was watching him at Gonzaga. He is a dog. Like, I'm like, man, like, and then I'm seeing like, you know, other guys throughout the league. I'm like, I think Hersilia had a guy named Lee Nalon, played in the NBA a long time. Like, I'm a basketball guy, I'm a basketball junkie. So I knew who Lee Nalon was. I was like, he was getting buckets for the Hornets. Like, and so like, I'm just looking at like, and it's just to name a couple guys that I remember from 14 years ago. That's how you know, like, I felt this way because I still remember that. And I'm like, man, like I come from Goshen. I'm like, man, am I in over my head? Am I ready for this? Like, you know, I needed to take, you know, a different lower level and work my way up. And I'm like, all right, we about to see a sink or swim. And so I'm kind of like going into those games, trying to figure stuff out. And you're playing against guys who played in major conferences, you know, SEC, ACC, you know, one of my good friends, Raymar Morgan, from Michigan State, he was a rookie there too. And so we had two different trajectories. He's from my city. So I'm just like, man, this is different. But I kind of like got my feet wet. One of the point guards got hurt in the preseason and I was able to kind of like get more minutes, get acclimated. And I really built my confidence up. I had a great preseason and I'm thinking like, okay, it's up, you know. Of course, when the guy comes back from injury, the season starts, you know, you're back to the bench. But, you know, I kind of built my confidence through that preseason. And that's where I felt like, okay, I'm not just as good as these guys. Like, I can, you know, outperform some of them on the night. You know, some nights they might get the best of you. Like, this is basketball. Like, you can be better or worse than somebody. But, you know, if you don't come in focused and ready or you underestimate, like, and I was catching guys sleeping. You know, you see a skinny frame. Mm-hmm. You see a guy who you don't really know on a rookie, like I know I was catching guys sleeping because they was relaxed. And you know, vets in the preseason, some guys be chilling, like, nah, I'm gonna go. Like, right. I'm trying to make a name. Like, I got 30 days to get this contract fully guaranteed. Like, there's so many things that they didn't even know that they probably like, why he guarding me so hard? Why he, like, nah, like this is why my is he life.
Picking
like,
me up full court.
Hey, somebody tell this rook, and that was even the rook, it's preseason. I'm like, I don't know what that means to me. This is a contract. I'll be on a plane home. And if I get home, it's going to be because I did everything I was supposed to do. I can look at myself with my head up. I'm not about to go home knowing I gave half-assed effort or I ain't put, you know, everything I had into the game.
I was telling Darian, like, scoring 82 points in any facet of the game, I don't care what level you're at, it's crazy. Would you say that was, like, the biggest turning point in your career where it came to, like, everybody knew, like, yo, Eric needs a contract?
Yeah, I think like the year before that, I started getting like a lot of NBA interest, a lot of workouts, a lot of stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't have a great experience at Summer League and I chose the wrong team. And it happens, it's life, but, you know, I still got a great deal out of China. I was so mad with Summer League that I was going to leave in the middle of it, but my agent talked me into staying.
Hold on. You ain't gonna speed past that. why were you so mad at Summer League?
Because when I was before I committed to the team, I had, because back then there was like two Summer Leagues, right? So there was Orlando and then there was Vegas. And right. So I was gonna go play with the Rockets in Orlando, but I had already committed to Denver in Vegas. And so Denver was like, all right, we want you to come to this training camp. You're going to play at least 20 minutes a game. We're going to have a training camp before, so we don't want you to go to Orlando to play with the Rockets. And I had already worked out with the Rockets, and they was loving me. And, you know, I was like, all right, like, this is a good opportunity. There wasn't a lot of draft picks, but, like, Denver was like, no, we need you to come to training camp. Come to Denver. You know, we're going to take care of everything. We're going to have the main guys come for, like, 7 days, work out. And then from there, we're going to go to Vegas, so we're going to be already ready. So me, not knowing the business like that and trusting, you know, people at their word, I'm thinking like, okay, like, why would I do this? What is guaranteed for me? And they're like, yo, 20 minutes a game. I'm like, okay, 20 minutes. I can make that shape.
Yeah.
You know, when we get there, it was more like 6 or 7 minutes a game.
Oh, damn.
and I'm just like, what? Like, I could have went to Houston for this. Did Houston or Orlando, maybe it's a different experience. And then I could have met y'all here in Vegas. So I just felt like, you know, lied to. And I felt like, you know, they weren't up for it or upcoming. And who knows, you know, things change. I know situations change, you know, but, you know, communicate that, talk about that. So I was ready to go home. But my agent was like, yo, it's a bad look. You don't want to do that. I'll play overseas the rest of my career. I don't care. Like, I'm not, I don't, yeah. My goal is to be rich.
Right.
I don't care about fame. Like, I could play overseas. I could walk through the airports. No one knows me. It's a beautiful life. Like,
it's cool.
Everything is cool. If I'm not in Ohio, it's cool. Ain't no camera in my face. I can enjoy dinner with my wife or my family. Like, if I'm not overseas or if I'm not in Ohio, I blend in. It's great. And he taught me into staying. But I was like, all right, I'm about to sign right now. And I was meeting with teams while I was in summer league. And then I signed my contract in the middle of summer league with China. And then I just kicked my legs back and was like, whatever. Now y'all can so do I'm what chilling. Y'all want to do. Like, do what you want. I don't even really want to play no more now because I don't want to get hurt. I just signed the biggest contract of my life at that time. I'm like, I don't even want to get hurt. And so that's kind of like where the mindset was. But, you know, when I was used to having success at that point, and I had never been in a situation where, like, I wasn't playing minus my rookie year. So it was like, that was an adjustment. I'm like, man, here we go all over again. Like, I didn't prove myself. So then go to China, and that's when I dropped that 82. And, you know, that's kind of like everybody knew I could score. But, you know, like you said, it's hard to score like that. Like, you got to be in great shape. You got to be a shot maker. You got to be a three-level scorer. You got to be able to get to the line. Like, all these different types of things. And, you know, I kind of, like, opened up the eyes of a lot of people. I think they already knew, you know, what I could do, but that kind of, like, put me on a level of, like, a phenomenal score. Like, not just a score, like, an elite score. And that was a turning point. And then that led me to Galatasaray, where I won a Euro Cup championship and Euro Cup MVP. And those two things, that year in China and that year in Galatasaray, took my career to, like, another level.
For those that don't know, just so, because I'm a stat guy too, I got your stats for that year. Do you happen to remember how much you averaged that season?
First year, I want to say a little bit over 39.
Yeah. 39.6, 5.5 assists, 4.6 boards. And the one that got me is this one right here, the 2.1 steals, because 2.1 steals period over any season would put you in the top five. Like, if you're in the NBA, it's top five period, right? But 39.6, you couldn't get to 40. You couldn't get to 40.
One more layup. Yeah.
So, no, that was crazy.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Always. So when we talk about now, you just said it put you on the map and it kind of took off. Now, for those that don't know, and we don't have to necessarily dive deep into finances, but when you talk about the contract you got from China versus the contracts that you got after that, what would you say the difference is? How large?
The difference is the year before I went to China, I could only get, like, I'd say, I was young, granted, but my offer range was like 150 range. I was 25 and I was like 150K. And then when I went to China, there were seven figures. Like, that was the jump. It's crazy. So, like, you're talking about 150,000, which is a lot of money. Like, that's a good way to start. You know, they paying for my car, my apartment, whatever. I'm 25 years old. And then, boom, that takes me there. And after that, like, before that, like, teams in Europe was, like, hesitant to get that seven-figure deal. Like, and then after, you know, they seen I went to China, it kind of raised my value, because with China, a lot of teams in Europe don't like the Asian market. But I was smart. I did 1 year. And at the time, China was only, like, 4 to 5 months on a regular season. Like, and I went right back to Europe. So my name was still hot. Yeah. I didn't stay too long, you know. And so me and my agent had the idea to go back and forth, you know, between Europe and China. And that kind of, like, teams realized that they had to pay. You know, I think a lot of guys have an idea of their value or their worth. And I'll always say, your worth is what somebody's willing to pay you. You might think you're worth more. You might think, but if you don't have an offer of that, no one's going to give it to you. So once I was able to get that offer there, then the other teams have to meet that. And so I'm able to get that in Europe. And then I went to Europe. They finally was giving me the money I wanted. And then I went back to China the next year, and China ended, and it was like 5 months. And then I jumped back to Europe in the middle of the season, 3 months left. And so I was playing both markets. So they couldn't say you playing in the Chinese league where it's not as competitive as Europe. Did you forget the flow? Like, I'm like, y'all, I did my thing in China. I played well. And now I'm coming back to Europe after being in China, and I'm about to do the same thing here. And that kind of kept my value afloat in both. And it kept both the European market and the Chinese market competing against each other. Now it's a little bit harder for guys because the Chinese season has increased the length. It's like almost 7 months now. So it's harder to bounce back and forth, but I kind of was one of the first guys to probably pioneer, like, going back and forth between China and Europe and maintaining a high worth in both of those markets. So, but that's the difference. That year, you know, you're talking a huge financial difference between like living a good life and then now being able to do ample amount of things off the court. And
So that's really the difference. So it's not, clearly it's not the talent. It's not the talent that didn't, like, why you're not an NBA. It was really just where the money was going.
Yeah, I actually had an offer. It was like 2015 or 16. And at this time, it was with the Atlanta Hawks. And it was to be the third point guard. And they had Jeff Teague, who was a dog at that time. He had signed, I think at that time, I want to say like 52 million. I couldn't remember how many years, maybe 4 years. And then Dennis Schroeder was a young draft pick, maybe had been in the league a year or so. And they wanted me to be the third point guard. And they were honest. They was like, look, you're going to be the third point guard. Jeff Teague's our guy, but Dennis Schroeder is our future. There's not going to be a lot of ministry. We like your game. We like what you have. We know that if something happens to one of them, you'll be ready. You're professional. You have the talent. But these is our guys. So you're going to sometimes get DMPs, sometimes play 5 minutes. But if one of them get hurt, yeah, you're going to play 15, 20 minutes for sure. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I got to wait for somebody to get hurt to play. I'm like, all right. So that's one thing, one strike. And then I'm like, do I really want to go? My mom and my dad and my brother was talking to me. And they was like, look, my brother's like, the lead is cool. I'm sitting the bench right now, too. I don't know if you're going to like that, you know, after, you know, playing the main role, doing what you like to do. Like, he was like, it's a lot of politics and stuff in between. And you could kill in practice. You can do all type of things. But if there's a draft pick, that draft pick's playing. Or if this guy just signed a certain amount of money, he's playing. Like, it's just per GM. That's how it go. And so we sat, we talked. And then at this time, the minimum of an NBA contract was only 400. And I want to say 69,000 around, give or take. So you talk about after taxes, you're losing, let's say if you're in a high tax state, you know, 45%. And then I got to pay my agent fee 4%. So let's just call that 50. That's 49, but let's just call that 50%. So let's say 470, now you drop to 235. Boom, just like that. And so I'm like, 235? Like, that was making, like, I'm like, what? And then they was like, now you got to buy your own place to live. I'm in the lead, right? I can't just live anywhere. Now I got to pay for my apartment or condo, wherever you want to go. You know, now you got to buy a car, like all these type of things. I'm just calculating all the expenses. And I just came from China. Like, so y'all think I'm about to take 7X less to be the third point guard?
Right.
Yeah. Like 7-8X? Like, come on. Like, that ain't going to work. And then the money just, my career kept growing. So now the overseas offers is just getting higher and higher. Like, and at that point, is you going to risk, you know, a year where, you know, you close to pushing two million or you 1.8 million, you going to go after you didn't build up your whole career. I didn't came from a place where I had to do 30-day contracts. You going to risk that $235,000 net for a third string point guard. So what happens if I get cut or I get, if things don't go right? Like, you get injured, anything. I wanted security. Like, I came from the NAIA. Yeah. Like, I'm thinking about numbers. I'm thinking about like what can put me in a position to where I'll be okay. So for me, I was like, yeah, I can't do it. Now, if you're telling me there's an opportunity for minutes for a role and then I can play my way into a contract, that's different because I always believe in myself. But there was no opportunity unless an injury occurred and I didn't want to take that gamble.
You had already technically been burned by the NBA, right, in the summer league. Now, if that conversation were to happen with Atlanta where they're like, yeah, you know what, Eric, we can guarantee you 14 to 16 minutes a game, right? You're still that third option for now. We'll see what it looks like with you and the rookie at that time, Dennis Schroeder, but gave you some more guarantees. What would have been your influence to actually believe in that, given the experience you had in summer league?
A multi-year contract. That's the only thing I would have believed in. Sure. If you'd have gave me a multi-year deal, I would have said, okay, I'm in your plans. But they was only offering a one-year deal. And I was like, nah, I'm okay. Right. Like, and that was for me, right? Like, some guys can take the chance and it might work out for them. Some guys become two-way players. They get the deal signed. Like, we didn't have that when I was coming in. There was no two-way deal. There was none of that between it. Like, you was either in the G League pay scale was way different. Like, it was an A, B, C scale. If you had NBA experience, your scale was $24,000 a year gross. If you was on the B scale, your scale was like, I want to say like 20 or $20,000. And then obviously I'm NAIA, right? Coming from a small school, no NBA experience. I would have been C scale, and that was $16,000 gross. So like these kids, you know, I'm happy for them. The game has evolved, it's grown. Now the G League is actually something that where you can live off of. But back in my day, like you couldn't live off the G League salary. Like all those guys either had a job or they was jumping to somewhere in like South America or Puerto Rico or the Dominican or something after the G League season. So like it was just, I came at a great time for Europe and China to have money and hold the rules right. But it was a bad time in the NBA when it came to like all these extra spots they opened up. Those two-way contracts opened up spots, those extra roster spots. I think they opened up two more extra roster spots, like all these different ways. And you think it doesn't sound like a lot, but if you add two ways and then two more roster spots, that's four spots. There's 30 something teams in the league. You just created 120 extra positions that didn't exist in my prime. Like, so, you know, I'm glad the game's grown. It's evolved. The money's increased. Now the minimum is what, maybe triple what it was when I was coming up. Like, what is it? A million one. Mm-hmm. And you know, in my era, 469. So like, you know, it's just the game's grown so much. And you know, I hope it continues to grow and continues to peak. But, you know, for me, a multi-year deal would have made me think, okay, y'all mean business. And, you know, I understand, like, do you really want to give your third point guard a multi-year deal? I'm sure you have guys lining up at the door to sign, you know, to be third point guard. You know, I was just in a position where I had leverage and where I was comfortable with playing in Europe. I liked it. Like, I liked the experience. I liked being gone, seeing different parts of the world. I like nobody asking me for nothing because they think I don't got it. Like, I like that. Like, that was a good life. Like, you know, no, you ain't in the NBA. You know, you're right. I'm not. I'm not. Yeah. Yep. I don't got it. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. My friend, he just actually just messaged me just now. He was just like, that's the best player that never played in the NBA. And I was just like, for real? Like, he was just like, and he was like, he averaged like 50, dropped 82. I was like, because he's a basketball junkie. He listens to that. He watches all the time. And then I'm watching your clips and everything. I'm like, yo, he is a bucket. But with that being said, like, how much was it that CJ kind of pushed you, or was that like a battle when y'all growing up? Was that something that y'all like went back and forth with? Or
I'm gonna stop him real quick. I'm glad he asked that because I don't think CJ pushed you. I think it was always you pushing CJ. But correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I pushed CJ. So basically, when we were kids, I was the one that made him get up. I woke him up out the bed. I was like, yo, we got to go work out. And he'd be like, I'm tired. I'd be like, get up. And we go outside and we shoot. And I started like, we didn't really know like everything about basketball. Like, you know, our mom played, our dad played. We just knew that if you shoot a lot, your jumper going to be wet. So my parents was both good shooters. And they was like, yo, you got to practice a lot. So we would go out there. And I just start like tracking our shots, and I would keep track of our shots. And I had a little notebook, like, and so it sounds crazy, but my brother probably at the time was like 7 years old. I'm 10 at the time. And I'm just out there like, all right, we got to make 200 shots, and we're going to keep track of our shots because I want to see how much we improve. And so I was charting our makes and misses. And so he got to the point where like, he get a ball, he shoot, I get a ball, shoot, and we just shooting, and we get on rebounds, and we shoot. And then sometimes we would rebound for each other, but I just felt like we needed to do cardio too. So I'm like, get your own rebound. And so he'd be like, yeah, I shot my shots. I'd be like, no, you didn't. I was running faster than you, and I got up more shots. Get back out there and shoot your shots. You didn't finish. And so, like, literally, like, I was constantly pushing away. And then as we got older, like, you know, it's the same thing. Like, he wanted to ride to school with me. At that point, I'm driving. I'm 16. He's 13, but we have two different schools. So like he is in eighth grade and my school starts way earlier, but there's a bus that would take him there. And I was taking him to my school. My school was maybe like an hour before his, maybe an hour and a half before. And so I'm like, all right, look, go to the gym, workout, and then take the bus. So he would work out and then go on the bus since he was like 13 years old. And then I was in like a special business honors program at my school. And so then that school started even the extra hour earlier before that. So sometimes I go to the gym, work out, and then I go to the class, and he obviously be with me because he wanted to ride to school with me. And you know, it was just constantly like pushing him. And you know, I just used to bully him when we was younger, like just hard on him, tough, just dogging him. And then like, you know, when you're young, you don't really want your brother to be with you all the time when he's younger. Right. And then when you know, my mom forced it on us and was like, yo, that's your brother, you know, whatever you do, he do. So imagine, like, he like 6-7 years old. He not that good yet. I'm 10. I'm hanging out with 10 to 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, and we playing basketball, football. And if he can't play, I can't play. So, like, he was always forced to play with kids. He was older. And then eventually he started to get good. And eventually, you know, his outs started to count in baseball. His shots started to count. Instead of us just giving him the ball to shoot a couple of shots, so he shut up and wouldn't tell mom. Like, he playing in the live action. And it was just those constant pushing and grinding and me being relentless, never letting him beat me, do all those type of things. Like, he never even beat me in the game of 1-on-1 until his junior year. He beat me in one game. He still couldn't beat me this year, but, like, he caught me slipping one game. And he was so happy. And that year, that's when they beat Duke, and he dropped 30. That's why after he beat me one game, I said, "You ready now?" I said, "You still can't mess with me, but you ready." And, like, we would always play seven-game series. I swear, he would probably tell you he couldn't beat me in a seven-game series until his second year in the league. Now it's now I still can get wins, but, like, he can get me the series. Like, he got too many tools in the kit. You know, it's just he got some stuff. But, like, it's competitive, but, like, you know, boy tough, you know. Like, there's a reason they pay him what they pay him. But that's how long it took. 2 years in the league, he couldn't get with me. Let him know I said it too. He know.
You know, as you were saying that story, something that resonated with me was the fact that, and obviously you've seen it, the Nassus when it comes to the NBA and Giannis gets a lot of flack for the shit that he does, right? But if you dive deeper into that story, similar to yours, I think what goes underappreciated is the fact that you, too, as older brothers, set the pathway for your younger brothers to thrive and grow into who they are today. I can't, and obviously a lot of people can't thank you enough for pushing your younger brothers the way you did. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Giannis. We wouldn't have CJ McCollum. We wouldn't have so on and so forth. So I just want to say thank you for that. That's amazing as an older brother. You said he couldn't beat you until a second year in the league, and I can see that. I mean, your highlights side by side are damn near identical. So
he copied my moves.
Obviously, both your parents played basketball too. Who instilled this into you guys? Well, if it was them, how did that come to be to where you guys, again, are identical players, but play at a high level? You don't see that often with brothers unless it's brought in from somewhere else. So how'd that happen with you guys?
I for sure got to credit my parents. So,
okay.
My mom made sure we did everything together. So, like, we'd be tight-knit. It made us force a bond that was unbreakable. And, you know, you hoop together. If somebody get in a fight, y'all get in a fight. This is just how we was raised. Like, and that's what it is. And so people might not see that side because, you know, we talk, you know, articulate ourselves. My brother's the president of the PA, but, like, you know, we from the city. Like, this how it is. Like, now we just, you know, went to a lot of good schools. We educated. But it's still there, you know, it's still there. And I think you see it on the court, you know, when it's time to turn up. But mostly, like, she always encouraged us to play sports, to do stuff, just to kind of keep us out of trouble because there's so many distractions in the city, drugs, gangs, violence, all type of stuff. And so, like, she knew a busy kid couldn't get in trouble because you didn't have time. So we was always in every sport, baseball, basketball, football, we did everything. And then eventually, it was becoming too taxing on my parents going to all these different sporting events. And my mom was like, "Yo, you got to choose something." And, you know, I chose basketball as a freshman. And that's when we were told to choose a sport, maximum two. And we chose basketball. And my brother copied the same thing because, you know, he looked up to me. And it wasn't our best sport. Baseball was our best sport for both of us. But, you know, we didn't pursue it just because it's not as practical. You know, in a city, it's not easy to play baseball, to do these things. Like, it's easy to go work out in basketball. It's easy to pick up a ball, easy to find a 505 game. And then there's more people who look like you, you know, it's just more comfortable. And so we chose basketball just because of a comfortability. And, you know, I would see that's what was in the newspaper the most. That's what got the most notoriety. And so my mom would always be like, when we were younger, if we was in the house, she'd start making us do OD chores. Like, "Oh, y'all want to be in the house in the summertime? Like, toilets need clean, floors need clean, this needs what?" We was like, "Oh, no, we getting outside." And so we just start being outside all day. And that's how, like, either you was going to be somebody who know how to clean up good or you was going to be outside playing. And then for my dad, like, he would always make us watch Michael Jordan. So, like, imagine you a kid, and I just laugh now because imagine you're, like, 3-4 years old and you want to watch cartoons. But but number 23 is on.
Right.
You watching number 23 because that's what my dad watching. And, you know, at that time, you know, one TV in the house, you watching 23. And that's how it was. Like, and when that 23 is over, okay, you can watch your cartoons. And so we were just constantly watching basketball. And that's how we started to love it and enjoy it. And we grew from it. And, you know, you start asking questions. You start wanting to be around the game. And your parents show you it. And obviously, like, they didn't have, like, the crazy training knowledge and other stuff, but they knew like the basics and the fundamentals of the game, and they knew like things that could help us to succeed. And I think those two putting that game around us, giving us those options, but allowing it to be a choice. Like, they never made me or my brother play basketball. They never tried to like, oh, y'all gonna play basketball, you're gonna buy me this house, y'all gonna, like, that was never the plan. It was just, we want you to go to get an education. My mom, my dad, you need to go to college. My dad's like, college is expensive. You need to get a scholarship. My mom, like, you can get one through grades or through sports, but you're going to have to work. And so, like, it's different. Nowadays, people put their kids in sports for them to go to the league. We was put in sports not to get in trouble, to stay away from the bad influences, and then to get an education. So, you know, that part of the game is kind of gone now. And I'm going to try to bring it back with my kids, you know, so that you don't feel like a failure if you don't make it professionally. Like, you still made it. You was had a good career. You became a doctor, a lawyer, whatever. And maybe you do make it. I don't know. But I'm not dependent on you. Your mom's not dependent on you. And we want you to blaze your own trail, your own path. And I think that's why me and my brother are successful, because it was never pressure. The family wasn't dependent on us to make it. My parents both worked. They both took care of us. So that's the difference.
If you could take an attribute or a skill set from somebody and bring it to your game, what would you take from somebody? And who would it be?
Oh, could it be something physical, like size?
Yeah,
it
could be anything.
Just skill. Whatever, whatever you think that would have pushed you even further than what you already are.
Oh, it would be physique. See, if I could add, like, more weight, because I have a frame that's just slender. It's just how it is. So, like the NBA looks at the eye test. So when you're coming up, if you look the part, you know, how many guys look strong, physically imposing, great athlete, but they're not really that good at basketball, but they'll take a chance on them, you know, because of that size. So if I could, you know, maybe had that size, you know, I'm 6'2", you know, it could be different if I was 6'4", or if I was 6'2", and instead of 180, you know, maybe you 6'2", 200, but like, my frame just don't gain weight like that. So, but if I could do something, I think that would be a skill set. I think I'm fine. Like, I can do everything on the court offensively. Yeah. Like, but just the size, just for the eye test, and then, you know, to make teams feel comfortable with it, especially when you're coming out like a college and doing those things, or when you're coming out of high school and you're trying to get a Division I scholarship, because everybody said, like, I had Division I game and I was a Division I player, but they said I didn't have Division I size. They didn't think I could handle the physicality coming out as like an 18-year-old. So if I would have been a little bit bigger, a little stronger, I think that's the difference. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can't control your body composition. You can continue to work. You can lift. You can do stuff. You can get stronger. But, like, some guys is not just going to be bulky. Like, everybody not LeBron James is strong. Like, everybody not going to be built like that. And that's life. But you got to make the best of what you have and put forward and maximize. And I think I was able to do that, to maximize my career. I never thought I would be here or, you know, have the career that I have now. I always believed in myself. I thought I was talented. I just wasn't sure I would get the opportunity to showcase this, especially based on how my career went, how I was slept on, how I constantly had to prove myself, how I didn't get the D1 scholarships, how I didn't get the playing time my first year. Like, so it was a constant thing. So people might say, how could you not see you were here? Like, if you see the battles and hills and the mountains I had to climb, you would have thought so too.
Yeah. You talk about size. In 2017, I think it was, you normally guard all the point guards. 2017, you did not guard one specific point guard who was, what, 6'8", 230, maybe, if you know what I'm talking about.
Luca.
What was that experience like for you?
Man, Luca was special. I mean, still is special. But at that time, you read about someone, you hear about them all the time, and you know, you're going into the yearly season and the first game of the year, Real Madrid, Luka Doncic, potential number one draft pick. And, you know, I think a lot of times young guys get overhyped just because they have potential, they have size, but the skill set hasn't yet caught up. or they have right. the skill set, but the size and the strength and the maturity hasn't caught up. Like, they're usually missing one of the two, either the skills, either the jump shot, or the physical attributes. This was the first time, minus LeBron James, that I seen a kid with the physical, with the maturity, with the pace, with the poise, not nervous, not scared, and with the skill set. I'm like, oh my goodness. And like, I mean, he had his way. I mean, he's posting up on the smaller defenders. He's taking the bigger guys off the bounce. Back then he was moving a little bit quicker. He's a little bit lighter, you know, than now.
Right.
You know, he's leaning on you, he's finishing. The pick and roll ability. I mean, I've never seen like 18-year-old kids, 17-year-old kids play pick and roll, like coming off, making the corner passes, the skip passes, hitting the short roll. Like, I mean, really filling it up, giving everybody touches, but then still finding a way to balance out his scoring. I mean, he did everything. If I can remember correctly, I think he might have been a leading scorer. I think he had like 24, and I think I had like 23 or 24. Like, I don't know. I remember he outscored me by a – what I had?
I'm going to correct you. He had 27 or 26. I ain't about to let you sell yourself short.
Yeah. I remember going into that game, and I was just telling my brother, I said, I know this kid is going to be a high draft pick, but I'm not about to be on his NBA draft highlight, you know, when your name from Slovenia, Luka Doncic, and then they just showing highlights of me getting cooked, and then my phone is buzzing. I'm like, nah, I'm about to hold my own. So like, it's going to be
then you got the team talking about, hey, look, Eric, we got to revisit your contract.
So I remember just saying that, and I know my brother watched that game, and he was like, he said, oh, he's a pro. He's going. And after that game, like, you know, I had never seen him like live, and I had skepticism, but after that game I said, oh, he's ready right now. And I mean, you see what he's doing. He's treating him the same way he did the EuroLeague, maybe even worse.
Eric Green said the same thing about Luka, which brings me to a good point. When you talk about being a basketball player, right, you don't see as much athleticism over there, but you see higher intelligence. So when you look at games that are being played in the NBA, and you obviously you participate in the games that are being played overseas, what is that difference for you when it comes to the competition level and how those games are actually being played?
I think the NBA is the best league in the world. I think when you combine talent, physical size, strength, speed, all athleticism, I think that's when you're getting the maximum value of players there, right? Are there guys who can play overseas in NBA? Of course. Are there guys who probably play in NBA would struggle overseas? Of course, we see it every year. I think the difference is because maybe guys don't have some of those same physical attributes, they're forced to use their mind a little bit more, right? So maybe you're a little bit more fundamentally sound here. You know, the fundamentals might be better. You know, obviously the effort and the energy is better in the regular season just because it's just a difference of game. You know, there's not 82. Right. You know, we're probably more in the regular. You probably, if you're on a really good team and you're playing multiple games a week, you're probably in that 60 range. But we're not playing back to backs, those type of things. And we're not playing 48 minutes. You know, we're playing 40 and there's more substitutions, those type of things. But I think the spacing is the biggest difference. Like, the court is so crowded. It's like a collegiate game. It's like you see a lot of guys who struggle in college to really get off, but they have a solid, you know, career, but they're not that star that they're supposed to be. And then they get to the NBA and they kind of like break out, and you see them really start to develop different parts of the game that you didn't see in college. I think in Europe, with the court being so small, with no defensive 3 seconds, with guys helping, clogging the paint, with a little bit more physicality, the hand checking, those type of things make it a little bit harder, you know, to find your opportunities. And you'll see it in FIBA play. A lot of guys might question, like Lucas said it, a lot of European guys have said it, some guys who've played in NBA have said it. You see guys struggle in FIBA, NBA All-Stars, and they get to the Olympics. Why is that? It's not the basketball. It's not the rims. Everything's 10 foot. It's the fact that there's no spacing. And so guys who come from the NBA, I always say, if you can shoot, you have a chance to succeed. If you're not a shooter, it's going to be really hard for you if you're not a big. So if you're a guard, you need to be able to shoot that pull up, that midi pull up or off the screen pull up. If you don't have that, you're not going to make a living in the paint unless you're just a freak of an athlete. If you're a prime Derrick Rose or Russell Westbrook, that's different. But most God didn't make a lot of those. So like, so you're going to need a jump shot. You're going to need some pick and roll skills. Like, I think the NBA outside of those max players is a specialty league. Guys are really good at one thing, and then maybe so-so at a lot of other stuff. And that's by design. Like, they practice just that skill set. If you're a corner three guy, or if you're a defensive guy, and a lot of times other parts of the offensive game struggle. Not saying that they can't do it. They just haven't done it in so long. You use it or lose it, right? Like, if you look at everybody, they were a bucket in college, or they were a bucket in high school. But if they haven't used that for 6-7 years, I've been stuck in this role. It's not easy. It's not a light switch. I can't just turn it on and just become this dynamic scorer or this do-it-all guy, or it's just not possible. Like, you have to continue to use your body, your skill set, everything to keep it sharp. And I think that's the difference. Overseas, you're going to have guys who can do more things because teams aren't going to pay you X amount of dollars to do one thing. Like, if you're a foreigner, they're going to want you to defend. That's why I'm out here getting steals. That's why I was out there playing defense. I was young. I was full court pressing. They're going to also still want me to score. They're going to want me to get assists, to create, to get people easy shots, opportunities. And then some teams are going to be like, yo, we need a few rebounds from you too, E. Like, and that's the difference in Europe, where you might be asked to do four things, five things. Where in the NBA, like, we need 20 from you. You're not going to guard the best player. You're going to guard somebody who don't score. Save your energy. And that's the difference, like, as far as a lot of success for players, and a lot of guys, you know, maybe not having that early success or struggling.
So do you agree with Luka then? If you average, let's say you average 20 overseas, do you feel you can average 30 in the NBA?
You would have to have the touches, the ball, the minutes, like the same type of thing. Like, your role couldn't change. But I mean, we saw Luka, I think that year, you probably noticed that's better, but I think he averaged 15 points a game, maybe 14-ish. And if I remember correctly, that year, that would have put you in the top five. I know it was like Luka, myself, and I can't remember who the other guys was, but it was like, that was like the top four scoring in the EuroLeague that year. I think maybe I was third or fourth. And he went from 14 and a half, maybe 15 points a game in the EuroLeague to that year in the NBA, probably close to 20, probably 18 points. Yeah. And so, like, did he get that much better in 4 or 5 months? Maybe, maybe not. Right. I don't know. But then the next year, he's like 24 games. Like, so it's like that's some big quantum leaps. And I think the skill set and the ability is always there. But the NBA rules are very beneficial for guys who can create space, who can find their shots, and for who can get buckets, because fans want to see scoring, right?
Yeah. Made Adam Silver's a smart guy. Sure.
Yeah. Right.
That's by design.
It's definitely made for entertainment. Yeah.
They're smart guys. They know what's going to keep the ratings up. And that's why they've adapted different rules, tinkered with them, changed certain things to keep that game flow going, to keep things, you know, safe for the star players so that they have health, but also to keep the quality of basketball high and keeping fans engaged. And fans want to see scoring. You know, they don't want to see that grinded out slugfest basketball unless it's March Madness. That's the only time that they like that. Any other time, the ratings are low, probably in the Big Ten, like all those type of leagues that just bruise. They don't want to see that. They rather see that upflowing, fast tempo, high flying, electric plays.
Who do you think your top five? Like, who are your top five players that you played against? I'm sorry,
Luka.
I mean, I feel like I know who number one is.
Yeah, Luka for sure. Yeah. Well, I actually got to go back because I forgot. I played with LeBron in the pro, so LeBron got to be first. So LeBron, Luka, my brother, and then Michael Beasley.
Thank you. Okay,
Michael Beasley. Oh my goodness,
that's the name.
Animal. He could do everything, man. Everything on the court. No offensive weaknesses. Like. Yeah. Like, he slept on, like, a lot of people don't realize how great he was as a player. Like,
I know. I just did a video on him last night about this. And then we were talking to Brandon Jennings, and he was like, yeah, when it comes to just pure hoopers, because I think there's a distinction between a basketball player and a hooper. When you talk about pure hoopers, Beasley was top two for him. So I was like, yeah. No, he doesn't get the respect that he deserves when it comes to shit like that.
Could shoot, could dribble, post up, strong, rebound, strong. Play pick and roll, pat, everything. Like, I was in China when I played against him, and we had an all-star game. And so I made all-star, Beasley made all-star. My mom happened to be visiting me at the time. And my brother was playing for the Portland Trailblazers. And I'll never forget this. Like, my parents are very honest. Like, I'm telling you, like, straight brutal. Like, I'm talking about, I'm like 13 years old, and they'd be like, yeah, you played good, but you know, you missed 3 free throws. Right. You did this, you turned her, like, they're gonna give you the good and the bad. Like, it's just how it is, even as an adult. And so she's watching the game, and she said, oh my goodness, who's that light skinned boy? And I said, that's Michael Beasley. She said, oh my goodness, he good. CJ and them could use him. He could go play for the Blazers right now. We need him. And I was like, she was like, that boy's amazing. I said, there ain't too many people like him. I said, he was a number two pick in the draft. I'm like, he was behind D Rose. And she was like, I can't believe they let him go, but they do miss a lot of guys. And I'm like, yeah, like, you know how it is. And she knows, like, cause she's around us. She's in the business. Like, she is just like, that's somebody who definitely needs to be back in the league.
Who's your fifth?
Hold on. Yeah. You still always one. Fifth? Yeah.
So the fifth one was tough. And I was really thinking, I would have to say maybe Marshawn Brooks, and the way he scores, the way he, like, moves on the court is effortless. Like, it just looks like he's never trying, but he's just consistently getting to where he wants to go, how he wants to go. Like, he really smooth.
Okay. Damn. So did you play against Mike James?
Oh, yeah.
I did play against Mike James.
Top five is tough.
It's tough. I know.
Mike is
all right. Let's keep it.
I gotta go, Mike, because he the number one scorer in the EuroLeague, like, number one in history. Yep. Like, you, mm-hmm. that speaks volumes. Mike is cold too. I mean, he got every shot in the book. He got every shot in the book.
All right, I respect that. I love the top five. So then let's broaden it out. Then so obviously that's the guys you played against. If you had to take a top five, period. I mean, anybody. Obviously, I would assume Jordan's in there because you grew up watching him. Oh, but who else would be the other four?
LeBron, Jordan, Shaq. And then I'm going to say, I love AI. I'm an AI guy. That's who me and my brother grew up, like, modern our game, watching him. Like, he gave us hope to see a little guy. So I'm going AI. Like, I know a lot of people ain't gonna like it, but this is my five.
Your five. Yeah,
and then I would say Tim Duncan.
I just did a video on TD.
He's definitely slept on.
Yeah.
And it's just because
they always forget Shaq and Tim Duncan when they do a top five. And I'm like, not remember what Shaq was at the five and how Tim Duncan dominated the lead. Like,
that's crazy. What I'm saying. We were just debating, like, every time we have people do their top fives with us, for some reason, people like to leave Shaq off that list. And I'm like, name a top five, period, that doesn't have Shaq in that fucking line. Excuse me, fucking lineup. Yeah. Like, come on, man.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. Crazy. And if I didn't go off of my favorite, then I would say, instead of AI, it would be Kobe. But AI is my favorite. Kobe is my second favorite player. But AI is my guy. So, like, but if I had to choose just strictly off who I think is the best, Jordan, Bron, Kobe, Tim D, Shaq for five. But if I just went off of sheer who I like, AI got to get in there.
I like that. We had a question that was brought up to us from one of the guys in the chat before, and it was like, If you remove the jump shot from Steph Curry and remove the handle from Kyrie, who's the better player? Now, preference, I think it's clear as day, but I could be wrong. I'm going Kyrie.
It's Kyrie.
Say something.
Look, my argument, I said I would pick Curry just because of the minor physical attributes that Curry has over Kyrie. But I'm saying it's not a landslide. I just feel like everybody's like, oh, it's a landslide. But like...
You don't think Kyrie is stronger? You don't think he has better mid-range? You don't think he's a better finisher? You don't think he's better in the post?
Keep going, brother.
You don't think he's a better space creator? Like, if you took away his handle, he still has post game. He still can
finish at the
Baja. He still has pull-up, and he still can play pick and roll. Steph Curry is a great player, but everything is predicated off of the jumper.
Who? Thank you. Okay, so let me ask you that.
I didn't say that's not reason.
Right. Okay, we'll get back to you in a second. So then, when we talk about handles, right? Steph Curry's name is brought up a lot with this. I'm not saying he doesn't have a strong handle.
They just have to guard him all the way at half court because he shoots too good. So you can get by anybody when I have to give you 0 inches of space. Like,
that's accurate.
He's a solid dribbler, right? But the handle is inflated because you
because
have
of the
to
jumper.
Be
because
so
of the
close jumper.
Okay.
You can't back up. I got to guard you at half court. So like one little flinch, one pump fake, I'm flying. Like, I have to respect
that. That's accurate.
Because you can't just contest. I got to jump and make it an even tougher shot.
So I guess yes, Kyrie would be better in that thing. But like we talk about emotions. You know what I'm saying? Steph is one of my favorite players. So like, I just don't feel like it's a landslide. Yes, it would be. But playing devil's advocate, I think Curry would still play. Because I think he does have a mid-range. Mm-hmm. He does. He has no post game.
So you think
you said
Steph
what?
Curry would be? You think Steph Curry?
Has no post
Steph.
Think,
Steph has no. Post
you think game. You think he would be in NBA if he didn't have his jump shot?
No.
Nah. Somebody told me there was a quote. They said if Curry didn't work. I mean, if Curry didn't have a jump shot, he'd be playing for Enterprise Rent a Car. But I don't know. It's just I respect very much. Like, I don't know. Kyrie is amazing in every aspect of the game. But I don't know. I just didn't think it was a landslide. But that might be my heartstrings.
I think Kyrie the most skilled basketball player we ever saw.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, for sure. For
okay.
Sure.
I'm going to test you on that.
Right hand. I mean, like, I don't know if there's anything he can't do.
I'm glad you brought this up. So Gilbert called me and he was like, hey, before we do this segment, I want to ask you, what do you define a skilled player as? And the first thing that came to mind, just like most people, is for me, Kyrie, Kevin, I think Steph's up there too, et cetera, et cetera.
Paul George. Yeah,
exactly.
George,
thank you. Too. But he said,
Kobe.
And the reason I'm going to say Kobe, Kawhi, LeBron are in the top 10 most skilled ever. And this is what we came up with. Gilbert said, when you talk about skill, the first thing that comes to your mind is always offensive ability, which is factual. That's probably 90% of the
battle. Footwork is in there too. Footwork is a skill.
Yep. Then we said, okay, well, is shot blocking not a skill? Learning how to time that to get it right, is that not a skill? Is right? Defense not a skill? So there's so many intangibles when it comes to skill. Exactly. That we need to start looking at what we actually see a skillful player as differently instead of just being offense. So that's something we're going to do in the coming days. If you wanted to talk about that later, we certainly can. But when we talk about offensive skill, night and day, Kyrie's fucking the best ever we've ever seen. So I agree with you on that.
Left hand, right hand, floaters, reverses,
angles,
angles, touch shot, glass shot. I mean, he's 6'2" and he can post you up. Like, you imagine, could literally run the triangle through him. You could literally do it and be fine. And he can pass, and he can create. Like, I mean, he can shoot every shot, one leg, two leg, going left, going right, step back left, step back right. I mean, everything he can do one direction, he can do the other. I mean, if you talk about weaknesses, he has zero on offense.
That's accurate.
Zero offense. Like, you don't guard Kyrie and say, all right, I'm going to guard him close. No, you're going to get
I'm
broke.
I'm going to sag off.
I'm going to sag off. He's going to hit the jumper. All right, I'm going to force him to the rim with the footers. No, he going to finish on them, too. we're going to funnel him to the mid. Like, there's literally no way to guard that. Like, other players, maybe they're okay at certain stuff, but there's a big drop-off if you take away usually a player's first option. But with Kyrie, there's nothing. Like, what can you do? We're going to make him play transition and fast pace. He going to do good there. Or we going to make him play in a half court. He got that, too.
He got that too.
And he got silent bounce too. He definitely does have silent bounce. Like,
especially Ramadan Kyrie.
Ramadan Kyrie. He's super light. So all right, so them right now, you building a team, you're a GM. Who you picking? Who you picking just regardless?
Ooh. You mean between Steph and Kyrie?
Steph and Kyrie.
Okay. Yep. See, I did the same thing.
Steph has this gravitational effect.
Gravitational pull.
He pulls everything to everybody.
Him just being on the court, everybody's going to be open. Like him running, because now the thing is why Steph is so dangerous is because he's good with the ball and off the ball. Kyrie's not that good off the ball. Like he doesn't run off staggers. He doesn't run off pin downs. He doesn't run off elevator because he's not a ball movement guy. Can he do it? Okay, but it's not something he's asked to do. But Steph is good on the ball or off the ball, which is really good for other stars. So if I want to pair him with a star, Steph can still go get me 30 off the ball. He can do it on the ball. Like, you can interchange him. But it's like Kyrie and Luka have to take turns, right? Like your turn, yeah. my turn. Well, with Steph, it can just be an offensive flow. So if you're going to pick a team, I'm going to go with Steph, one, because he has that pool. He's easier to play with because of how he moves, how he creates, yeah. all those type of things. And then also, if you're thinking about the financial aspect, he has a bigger name in the grand scheme of things when you're talking about kids, dollars, money, box office. So you compare all those things. Steph is the guy that you choose.
So then I have to ask you, because you're bringing up some excellent points there. Dynamic duos. Going off of what you just said, Kyrie and LeBron, Steph and Durant.
Steph and Durant was fluid. Because fluid. They both don't need the ball. Like, it wasn't forced. Like, with LeBron and Kyrie, LeBron kind of had to get off the ball or, like, go ahead, Kyrie. I'm a shrink myself sometimes. It's your turn. Or Kyrie had to shrink himself sometimes for LeBron to do his. Like, it was always like a your turn, my turn. It wasn't just a flow. Like, I felt like the Golden State Warriors were just running plays, and somehow Steph and KD would score. It would be in a flow to offense, or they would create. It wasn't forced. It wasn't five guys watching on the perimeter. It wasn't straight iso ball. Like, it was plays into a flow, into an action, into a quick attack, into a score. Like, it was just more beautiful to watch. Like, that Golden State offense was
excellent. Smooth.
I got to go with it. But Kyrie and LeBron was just more like, I'm unguardable. Give me the ball. Get out the way. Like, yeah. And that's really good for those two, but it hurts your role players, and it makes it hard for them to have functional games when they're going long periods of time without touching the ball, without feeling intertwined. Yeah, nobody wants to play defense for 48 minutes. Like, and then the last 4 minutes, you got to shoot some clutch shots and you haven't been in the flow all game.
Yeah, I say the same thing, but that's also why I appreciated J.R. Smith towards the back end of his career, because that's exactly what he had to do. And that's exactly what he delivered, minus the, you know, the fuck up. But
yeah, he was excellent.
Yeah.
So if you're a spot up shooter, and you can't create space, and you're going to want to play with LeBron and Kyrie, you know. But if you're a guy who likes to do some things, who likes to create your own offense and do those things, you're going to want to play with Steph and KD, because they're going to give you an opportunity to do that. And JR could do everything at that time. Let me clarify that. He could do everything, but he adapted his game.
He took that role, yeah.
Because he was looking like Kobe in them early Denver years. Like, some of the shots off the drill, like, like baby Kobe.
We talk about elite scorers. Obviously, I think you're in that category, especially overseas. But if we talk about NBA, Carmelo or Durant?
If you want to talk about, like, there's nothing you can do about it, I'm going to get it. It's Melo, because he could do it with brute force, physicality, in the post, mid-range, threes, driving. Young Melo was finishing over you, through you. But if you're talking about efficiency, beautiful buckets, purity, from a basketball purist standpoint, from it being in the flow of the offense, from it not being forced, from everybody still being involved, from a guy who can maybe go get you 30 and it might take 13 shots, it's going to be Durant. Sometimes you want Durant to be a little bit more aggressive, but, I mean, he's the guy that, you know, can really dominate a game and always be like, man, he didn't feel like he shot that much. And then you look at the stats and you're like, oh, he had 30. Like, where Melo's going to impose himself in the game, he's going to force himself in the game, and he's going to be very good at it. Like, he's setting the tone early. KD, more of a guy that lets it come to him.
So, again, another conversation I was having, when you take two teams, right, and you don't see this often in any aspect, but you take two teams that are competing for a championship, you have one team that has the basketball IQ, right, but they don't have as much experience. So they have talent and IQ. Opposing team has experience and talent. Which one of these two teams are more likely to win?
What's tough is the young players, usually their IQ is a little bit slower, but if they have the IQ, like you said, I'm going to go with the younger players, because the talent, the physicality is there, and they have the IQ. But you're going to need a couple of experienced guys sprinkled in there to kind of relax the situation. If it's all young guys, I'm not going to go with them, just because they haven't been in that moment. They don't know what to expect. A lot of these guys might not have faced adversity. So you're talking about five-star athletes, right, who came out McDonald's All-American. You know, you've been flying private, doing stuff since you was 14, 15 years old. Some of you kids are having meal deals at that age, might be already millionaires. Then you go to college, everybody caters to you. Coaches are scared to coach you because you'll transfer, you'll leave schools, you'll shut down, you'll stop playing. You're already on draft boards, your world, and your life has kind of been plotted out since you were 14 years old. Where's the adversity in basketball? Maybe there's adversity in your life you know, off the court. But in basketball, you have never faced a trial tribulation because you've been that guy from day one. Then you get to the league, you're an early draft pick, the ball's given to you, everything's going your way. What happens when you're getting killed on national TV for bad performances, or when things aren't going right, or, you know, when they're constantly draining you mentally? You know, the media can be very blunt, rough. And it can be rough on you. And a lot of young guys, that's hard to live with and to deal with, you know, and it can upset, you know, not only you, your family, all type of things. So you have to be able to take your emotions out of that. And I think I always go with experience if they're still like in that age grade where they can kind of still play at a high level, they can do stuff. But, you know, young guys with right vets, it can be a beautiful thing. And I think that's why you see guys like, you know, you did Giannis Haslam playing for so long, you know, the things he brought, you know, off the court. That's why you see LeBron still being so successful, because a lot of these younger guys don't have the IQ yet or the experience. You know, obviously he's a great talent, but, you know, he's a guy that's just so smart beyond his years. You see a lot of Andre Iguodala those years with Golden State. Not only was he, you know, the voice, you know, the focal point that held them together, this is the guy that actually made huge plays in the finals, was a finals MVP when people probably thought his career was possibly over. But, you know, you see, you know, what he can do. And I think every team has those caliber guys, you know, who win championships and, you know, who are going to help you, you know, get over the edge. And without that, you know, you can be as smart as you want, but you've never been in that situation. It's tough. Like, it's like being a parent, right? You have an idea, you read all these books, you prepared, but you have no clue till you have a child, you know? And I think those experienced guys, they're somebody who's already had a child, right? So they're going in, they've been here, they've been in that championship. You know, they've seen that, they've seen this kid grow. Now they're more prepared for the second kid. And that's kind of how I compare experience.
On the names you listed there, obviously championship caliber players on championship caliber teams were not the main focal point or main guy that have the IQ experience that you're referring to, outside of someone like LeBron James, right? Because it's LeBron James. So the game or the teams that I'm referring to actually in the 2021 finals are Milwaukee Bucks versus Phoenix Suns. Phoenix Suns, in my case, or in my opinion, being the more IQ-ish team, whereas the Bucks have the experience and talent. I'm saying, and forgive me, Kyle, because this is one of his favorite players ever. Am I wrong for saying Chris Paul is not that guy or can't be that guy? I mean, history has kind of shown that a little bit.
I think he could have been the guy that year in Houston when he got hurt.
When he got hurt game six.
Good point.
Oh, man.
Good point.
Yep. Me up.
That game six, that was the year when he was at his peak. He was playing well. He was smart. His IQ was high. And they were really controlling the series. Yeah. And I think
that damn spin was his move.
Yeah. He was cooking. I think he was dominating. And he was so special. I think that was his point. I think now it can't be. He's at that point where, you know, he's declining. And, you know, everybody can't decline like LeBron. His decline is still ridiculous. Like, you know, everybody's at a different, you know, body type, a different composition. And some things, you know, aren't built to last forever. And I think when you look at Chris Paul's injury history, you know, you look at his body, you look at those type of things, you know, he just hasn't been fortunate health-wise. And so those injuries, they wear, they tear, they wear on you as you get older and older. And I think Father Time has caught up, because this is a guy who was one of the greatest point guards, you know, of this generation. You know, when you're thinking about those New Orleans days, when you're thinking about, you know, all that success he had, what he was able to turn that into, and, you know, kind of how he spearheaded those Rockets teams before the injury, like, you know, this is a high-level player. And, you know, he had one window, one shot, and you need the perfect team. And basketball is a tough game. Like, you could be the best player you want to be, but if you don't have the right pieces, if you're not clicking at the right time, if you don't have health, like, everything kind of has to fall together at once. And you don't have to be the best team, but you just have to be playing the best at that time. And that's kind of what you saw with those Miami Heat teams that kind of made those deep runs, kind of made some upsets. They weren't the best. They didn't have the most talent, but they were playing the best at that time. And that's what kind of triggered them. And I think that's the key. So I think Golden State, if that's who you're referring to now, since CP is there, like, I don't see the championship even a chance in there. I mean, the West is loaded. I mean, think about Denver, I'm not going to count OKC. They're great, but they're not ready yet. They're too young. Yeah. They don't have that experience, but they're excellent. But I still think that's Denver's opportunity to do something with it until somebody knocks them off. And then, even then, maybe Phoenix might be able to do something, but they pigeonholed themselves. by you know, being in the play-in. Same with the Lakers. Like, those teams have experience, they have good players, but you know, it's very hard to get out the doghouse, like when you dig a hole like that. And then you still think like the Clippers are loaded. Like, if any they could just stay healthy, they're the best team in the NBA. Like, you just if they have the experience, they have the championship knowledge, they have a good coach. Like, if they don't get injured, I'd be shocked if they don't win the championship. Like, the only person that maybe can knock them off because they match up bad against them is the Pels. If the Pels can maintain maybe that fifth spot or the fourth, that's a bad matchup for the Clippers. Like, they just have watched the games in the regular season. They have the size. They have the matchups. Like, they have guys who can, Herb can guard, you know, Kawhi. You know, they have the pieces that can put there. Brandon Ingram can get in front of Paul George. Like, they have the length. They have the size. Not going to be easy, but they have the bodies. And then there's no answer for Zion. So if you just especially think, like, they have nobody to guard him. So you think about matchups, like, what are you going to do? You going to put Kawhi and Paul George on Zion and he could just go through them and bully ball all game?
That's 10 fouls.
He's running through them. And, you know, with their injury history, is that what you really want to do?
Like, I agree with you, but at the same time, like, it's hard for me to bet against a healthy Kawhi. Like, as much as we talk about his injury history, which is obviously a factor, and it's a lot of the reason he hasn't been able to do anything in recent years, Kawhi is one of the scariest superstars, I think, in the postseason when healthy.
Animal. Yeah. And Paul George, and then the sleeper, Norman Powell.
Norman Powell.
That's the sleeper.
He's the X factor
on that team.
Yes. He's
the difference. And so when you put that together, to me, the Clippers is the best team in the NBA. It's just a matter of, can they be healthy? You never know. Right. Denver has the best chemistry. Boston has the most talent.
Thank you.
You know, you start looking at all these different things, and it's like, which one is going to give? And for me, the Clippers is the best. But if one guy gets injured, you know, everything changes. And it's highly likely that could happen to them because it's happened so much. You don't even want to get your hopes up for what they could be.
I agree. And you look at PG, obviously Kawhi, even James Harden has had an injury history. And then Russ is normally healthy for a long stretch. He's had recent injuries too. So it's up in the air. I agree with you on that. But I like that.
On paper, definitely.
On paper, for sure. Oh, yeah. You brought the Suns. And this is actually a video I'm probably going to do later this week because I think it's going to happen. Isaiah Thomas obviously signed a 10-day with them, which was phenomenal for the NBA, phenomenal for him. I loved it. But the problem with that is, and you tell me your opinion on 10-day contracts in general, when you sign someone like that, especially towards this part of the season where every game, especially in the West, counts and you need to get these dubs, you're not playing him, right? So from an inside perspective, are you only looking at Isaiah Thomas for veteran leadership, chemistry? If someone gets hurt, obviously you need someone to come in. Is that what you're looking at this for? Or is it just, we just, you know, we're signing him 10-day, we're going to let him go. It is what it is.
I think they wanted to see if he was healthy, right? You know, he's a guy that could help you potentially in the postseason. You know, right now it's too much to ask of somebody to come in, maybe not in mode as far as tip-top basketball shape. Yes, he's been working out, he's been training, but that's the difference between being in the games, getting up and down the court, practicing every day. So you bring him in, you see where he's at, right? And if he can be potentially a spark off the bench, scoring with the Suns, history with injuries this season, it's been awful. So now you have a guy who, if one of your main guys go down because for some reason their big three can't play together, like, I don't know why, they just they're always injured. You can't get Bill, Booker, and Durant all together. So, you know, to make a deep run in the postseason, now you need three guys who can score. And I think he's insurance in case one of those guys can't. And he might not be consistent with it because he's been out for a while. He might not be able to do it every night. But if there's one game, and IT has that ability we've seen in the past, that he could change the outcome of a game. And it might not be 30 points like old IT, but it might be a quarter where, you know, the offense is struggling. They're not scoring. And you're able to get, you know, 10, 12 points out of him that quarter. Yeah. And he maybe he finishes the game with 14, 15 points, but he had a quarter where he changed the series. And if that only cost you a 10-day contract, when you're thinking of financial terms, when you're thinking of cap space, then that's the guy that you take because it does cost you nothing. Like, there's nothing you lose there. He's a guy that actually has a good fan base too. Like, it's a good feel-good story. And then if anything, you're bringing in a vet who's been humbled, who's coming in with good character, who could be a leader to some of the younger guys, who can, lean on and his experience. He's been in big games. You know, he's been in big game seven. He's faced adversity. You know, the death of his sister when he was able to go out there and go crazy. I don't know what 50. And it just shows you that he's mentally tough and strong. And if anything, even if he doesn't get you scoring off the bench or he doesn't even have an impact on your games, you're bringing in somebody who could be good for your team camaraderie and who's mentally strong, and you can never get enough good team guys, you know. So whether it's him or another guy, if you're going to use him or not, you want to bring in a good character. And I think that's what the Suns was looking at, because there's going to be adversity in the playoffs. There's going to be ups and downs, and for them it could be in the play-in. And I think a guy like him, having his knowledge, his experience, it could be valuable whether he plays or not. It could be a Udonis Haslem role, or it could be, you know what, someone got hurt, we're going to throw you into this series. Go shock the world.
Do you think if you have a 10-day contract that there should be some type of like minimal amount of minutes that you should play? Like the other day we're sitting there, I forgot who they're playing, but they were up by like 50.
Spurs. I think they were
the Spurs. Yeah, they were playing the Spurs. They were up by like 30 in the middle of the third quarter. And then when he got to the fourth quarter, it's like 10 minutes left. They still up by a good amount. Not saying you should just throw them in there, but like, do you think they should be in there? Because like at that point, it's not garbage minutes, but you're looking for to see if he still got it, if he can still move up and down the court.
And as you know, I know there's a lot of variables, right? Obviously, LeBron and JJ Redd just talked about this. You can't be up 20 with 7 minutes left in today's era because you could still lose that game. We get that. Yeah. And there's a lot of other factors, but I was thinking, I don't know, if you're not getting it, if you're not looking at it from a team aspect, which you can see in practice and how it actually works out on that side of things, then I don't know. If you're up 25 points with this left, can he not get 3, 4, or 5 minutes? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think 3 to 4 is reasonable. I think 10 is too much, only because he just got there. As a coach, you risk losing the team. If you give a guy just minutes who just got here, and there's guys who've been busting their butt, who've been working, who've been grinding, who've been doing all these things all year, and you know, this is your time to reward them, to see what you have, to see who you could potentially use in the playoffs. In the play-in series for them, all these things you have to tinker with, right? But I want to see what IT has, so I'm going to throw him out there in the mix, and I'm going to talk to him before I do it because he's a vet. I want to know, like, hey, I want to get you some game action. We're up by a lot. I don't want you to feel disrespected because I know, you know, your career you had. How you feel about going in there giving me, you know, a good 4 or 5 minutes strong if we can continue to maintain this lead? And, you know, based on his energy and his effort, whatever he say, you know, that could be the difference between him getting that another 10 days added to his contract, or that could be the difference between me being like, you know, we tried, this ain't going to work. You know, so if it's anything other than, yeah, coach, I'm going to get out there, I'm going to do it. Because when you're in a 10-day contract, you don't have no leverage. Like, you at their mercy, you just lucky to be there. And I think that's his mindset. Like, he been wanting the opportunity is here. Now you have to deal with whatever role you get. You know, you've been working, you've been grinding, you've been, you know, saying you want to do this, you want to do that. And he's been talking to, you know, kids, doing certain stuff, like sharing his experiences. So you can tell, like, mentally, I feel like he's ready for that. So I wouldn't give him 10 just because he just got there. And I want him to earn his keep, earn his way. And I want to reward the guys who already been there, because anytime you get up by that amount of points, you know, it's not a great opportunity throughout the nights to continue to play your bench. And this is the best time to do it because you're up so much. But for 3 to 4 or 5 minutes, like, you know, you got to test that out. If not, why is he even there?
That was my thing, too. So what if it's not, and just brainstorming, what if it's not 10 minutes in a game, but more or less 10 minutes minimum over the course of that 10-day? Because that's normally 3 games or so, right? Yeah. So we're giving him about, you know, 3 minutes and 20 seconds per game during that time. Do you think that'd be enough?
I think they should scale it. So see, you know, give him 3, 4 minutes, give him a run, see how the team plays, you know. How was the plus minus? How was the game flow? The things fit? You know, does he know all the plays? Are things going seamlessly? And then the next game, you know, maybe you can tick it up a little bit more. You know, maybe instead of 4 minutes, maybe it might be 7 or 8 minutes. And if he's in the plans for you, you know, potentially in the play-in and for you to make a run. That's the only reason I would do it. And then if things go well there, then the third game I would uptick it a little bit more. And then we would know what we have. And he would probably be in that 12 to 15 minute range, you know, just seeing what I could get if we got to that point where he was somebody I could utilize. Because, I mean, Bradley Beal's probably going to play 38 minutes. Yeah. Devin Booker's going to play 38 minutes. And KD, yeah. KD's probably going to play 38 minutes. So there's not like a ton of minutes. And he can't really play KD's minutes. It's a size difference. He really got to play minutes after one, unless you pair him with a tall guard. So, you know, there's not like a ton of time available, and I'm sure they want to use that big three together and then stagger their minutes. And then when they stagger them, where maybe one or two are out there, they're going to run the offense through them. And then when another one comes in, they're going to run the offense to him to try to keep everybody's touches, you know, afloat and to keep everybody involved in the game. So even if he's out there, he's not really going to be able to be IT because they have three very dominant guys.
Not only that, but you can't forget about how great Grayson Allen's playing as well. So you got to triple him in there.
That's what I'm saying. So whose minutes do you take? That problem isn't should IT play. The problem is who shouldn't play.
Yeah. Let's go with it.
So the last one I got for you is clearly you've had a great career, like, and still currently going. It's been very successful for you. But I asked, like, how do you, like, in your opinion, like, how do you describe what success is? Like, what is success for you?
For me, success is maximizing what God gave you, right? Every day, taking that gift. It doesn't matter if it's academics, if it's art, if it's music, if it's what, taking it every day and working on it. And by you working on it, by you respecting it, you know, it shows that you're grateful for the gift. You know, you don't waste that gift. You know, he blessed you. He chose you, you know, to do this, whatever it is you're supposed to do in life. So you owe it to him to maximize that and to take it to whatever level you can. And then after doing that with that gift, I think you need to do impact, you know, to other people, whether that's something given back, could be financially, could be preferably also time, energy, effort, helping others, you know, because, you know, he bestowed all these things upon you and put you in a position to be where you at. And then you did your part. You worked, you grinded, you put forth the effort, you spent all that time. So, you know, it's kind of like yin and yang. Y'all both working together. Y'all need each other. And then now you're able to pass that on. I think, you know, that's true success when you can help others, you know, get to where they want to get and have a positive impact on people. Like when people come across you or they meet you, you know, they should feel, you know, something special, whether it's, you know, just your energy, just your aura, just your positivity, just your upliftingness. You speaking life into people, like, to me, that's success. Like, it's not about how much money you make, none of that. It's not about how, what level you get to. It's about whatever you're good at, maximize that, push that, and then use that gift to help others. And that's what I've tried to do. And I think I've been successful with that, and I'm still trying to continue to work on it. I think the work's not done. You know, as long as I have, you know, breath in my lungs, I'm gonna continue to try to push that narrative. And, you know, sometimes it might be the young guys on my team. Sometimes it could be friends, family members. Sometimes it could be something totally outside of basketball. But, you know, I try to speak life into everybody, and I try to help, and I want to see everybody eat, because, you know, there's more than enough food out there for everybody. You know, everybody can be successful in their own lane. You know, your success doesn't take away from me. Mine doesn't take away from you. You know, we can all be in this together. So that's true success. And I think that's where happiness lies, because if you do those things and you're giving back and you're making that impact, how can you not be happy with yourself?
Obviously, with all the success that you have had and are currently having, you're on that back end stretch of your career. So, right. So what's in the plans for the moment you take off that jersey?
So I'm torn between two things. I'm gonna always put the family first and, you know, take care of the kids and, you know, spend time with wifey and stuff. But I'm very interested in still being around the game, but I don't want it to affect my family dynamic just because I've been away so much, you know, and I get to see my immediate family all the time. But what about my extended? You know, I don't get to see my parents as much as I like, you know, my cousins, my aunts, my uncles, you know, life is short. But, you know, with that said, you know, I'm curious about going into the broadcasting industry. I've already been, you know, getting my reps, getting my practice, being around the game, talking about it. You know, I want to be someone who, you know, articulates the game, teaches the game, you know, but also, you know, lets you know what's going on. You know, I want to be different. You know, if I choose that route, you know, I want to be someone, I don't want to be one of those old guys who hating on the young guys making all this money or playing. Like, I want to be somebody who's like, who's positive. Like, you know, like I watch Allen Iverson, how he talks about the young generation. And I just love it. Like, he speaks nothing but positivity. Yep. And that's something I can get behind. And that doesn't mean I won't critique you. That doesn't mean I won't let you know when you didn't play at your level or you didn't do something. But I'm not going to use it as like a platform to bash people. You know, I'm going to just try to stay true. And I know it's not easy because they want clicks. But, you know, that's, I want to be a purist. And then secondly, people have been trying to get me to go into it, but I just feel like it's too time demanding, and it's coaching. You know, yeah, I know, like, it's just, And with this air, like, you can't really coach kids like you used to. They'll transfer on you immediately. You have to lead with money. Everybody thinks their kid deserves everything at once. No one wants to take the long route, you know, to take the detour. No one wants to get it out the mud. You know, they want to play right away as a freshman, you know, which was, you know, not the typical way that things started. You know, imagine if, you know, would Michael Jordan be Michael Jordan, you know, if he, you know, have maybe a minimized role at North Carolina until, you know, he hit that last shot. You know, he's not the only one. You know, other guys, you know, took a long route and they became great players, you know, or they was an okay player as a freshman and they grew, you know, Kawhi Leonard, you know, like different guys like that. So
I just look at like those first couple years in LA.
So like, I feel like, would I be too blunt? Would I be too rough? Would it be too hard? I don't want to like kiss players' butt. Like, I want to be nice. I want to uplift you. I want to help you grow as a man, but I can't do that if I can't coach you. So, you know, that's the tough part. You know, coaching pros is even worse because they make too much money. They already think they know everything. So at least a college kid, maybe you can help mold. But if you're too hard on him, he'll quit. He'll transfer and the portal's open and somebody's going to take them. So those are the two aspects I'm thinking about. You know, obviously, like, I'm big in real estate. And, you know, I have a few franchises and, you know, stuff like that. So those things are kind of flowing. They're already going. You know, I have a good management team and, you know, I kind of keep my flow on that. But I'm trying to do something else where I can, you know, have fulfillment of still being around the game, but also where I can help others. I feel like, you know, God gave me a lot of experiences and bless me with, you know, the platform and the knowledge to not only to know basketball, but to continue to grow it and learn from so many different countries, different people, different players. You know, 14 years in, you know, God willing, I can continue to go more. But I just feel like it would be selfish of me if I didn't find a way to give some of that back. So that's my plan. So whether that's through broadcasting or coaching, we shall see. You know, my wife likes broadcasting better because she thinks I'll be home more. So, and I have to agree with her. It does look that way.